Collective Insights is a voyage through topics and technologies revolutionizing human well-being. Groundbreaking approaches for a better world and a better life await you. Welcome to Collective Insights.
Okay, welcome to the NeuroHealth Collective podcast. My name is Daniel. I'm with Research and Development here at the Collective, and we are super honored and excited to have Mark Devine with us today. Everyone that we've had on the show is a world-class, incredible individual. Mark is as unique a person as I think exists in terms of his extremely diverse, eclectic background. So Mark was a Navy SEAL and then became a trainer and a commander for the SEALs. And then after retiring from the SEALs, continued to train and to this day trains elite forces in both physical training and mental, emotional resiliency and toughness training. He started his career as a SEAL after having an MBA in finance and a degree in economics and kind of working in high finance. And he's got multiple black belts in different traditional martial arts, other advanced training in other martial arts, as well as hand-to-hand combat, and was actually taking the beautiful part of the traditional martial arts that was kind of stripped away in combat mixed martial arts had a lot to do with the spiritual traditions, and he was training in the meditative and spiritual traditions all along the way. Studied integral philosophy and actually created kind of a world-centric warrior and world-centric leader program, and then has taken this kind of leadership training and elite performance training to all different kinds of leaders around the world, as well as having done entrepreneurial work to take these kind of best of peak performance to the world. So I think Mark is in a category by himself of someone that has this degree of actual military elite forces training and an actual embodied philosophic work, and has put that together to what really strikes me as like the closest thing to at least the way I romanticize what the samurai were in terms of a real immune system for the world. And when we kind of think about issues of police brutality and like where the protectors of the world are at today compared to what they need to be, Mark possibly offers something so unique and for so many different reasons. So Mark, thank you for being here with us.
Daniel, thank you very much. And thanks for that intro. That was really nice.
So I want to just start with, I know you developed a whole system of yoga that is working with mental and emotional and mindfulness training that's very unique. You've got physical training that is developing mental toughness through the body, lots of things. I'd like to know, in all of your decades of training across all of the different things you've done, what is most meaningful and foundational that you would like to see more people learning about and getting engaged with?
Yeah, powerful question. I think that we're at a point in our development as a humanity or as a race where I would like to see a lot more people step into their fullness as human beings and to operate out of what I call Kokoro. And Kokoro is the name that we use both for our most extreme training in SEAL Fit, which is modeled after the Navy SEALs Hell Week, which is 50 plus hours long, as well as our yoga program. Kokoro comes from the Japanese martial tradition, and it means heart-mind, or merging the heart and mind into action, or the divine heart of the warrior. How nice. A little tap there with a divine name. So this idea of cultivating the divine heart of the warrior requires true integration. And this is one of the reasons you mentioned I studied integral theory. I was so drawn into Ken Wilber's work because I have been working on a process of and a practice of integration since I was 19 years old, and I began studying Zen with the martial arts, which is an integrative program drawn from that Japanese warrior tradition that had a close ties to the samurai and the Budo world, did not know it at the time. Now, for me, I was just practicing Zen and practicing the physical training. But certainly in retrospect, what I realized, and I mentioned laughingly earlier, that our grandmaster, Mr. Nakamura, was a Zen master masquerading as a karate teacher. He was a really unique human being in our culture to have that ability to transmit, you know, that integration of character that accrues through practicing both the inner and the outer in a very sensible way that is appropriate for someone's stage or age of development. So back to your original question, I think that everyone would benefit by beginning or enhancing their lives through a daily personal practice of integration, which is what we attempt to achieve with our Kokoro yoga training. And, you know, integrating body, mind, and spirit, integrating egoic self with your higher self, integrating East and West, integrating physical, mental, emotional, intuitional, and spiritual aspects or domains of one's being. And the outcome of that is that, you know, you really step into your fullness and you accelerate your development as a human being and quickly achieve, you know, kind of a sense of world centrism where, you know, all sentient beings are respected and loved. The world is something that's a sacred place and, you know, deserves our attention to protect and to nurture. Not unlike the native warrior traditions, you know, had a lot of, you know, at their highest level, even though culturally they weren't as evolved, you know, they had this great respect for the culture. They had great respect for their enemies. They had great respect for each other. And so in a way, the Kokoro heart breeds respect. And I think respect is something that's been lost in our society. And there is a way to train it and develop it. And there's a way, you know, it with skillful means, we can teach people to become their own gurus and to develop their own selves to the highest level so that we can engage in society more meaningfully and more powerfully and with more respect. That was a long-winded answer to your fairly simple question.
No, it's beautiful. So when you look at the current state of affairs in the world and you look at the extreme and increasing radicalization and divide in the U.S. between left and right politically, and the alt-right and white nationalism, the kind of extremism of controlled left that is partially driving the alt-right, and you look at the increased kind of distributed military capacity on all sides of non-state actors, and then you look at these dynamics globally, and you're talking about respect for one's enemies and respect for all sentient life. The problems that we currently face at a societal level seem close to insurmountable. Mm-hmm. What would you say might be offerable to those kinds of issues from the point of view of the kind of training and values that you're speaking of?
Well, you know, what we're seeing here, you know, the law of polarities, you know, in effect in an accelerating world, which is creating great breakdowns in the old institutions of the industrial age. And we truly are entering the age of the warlords because they're, you know, they're stepping up to fill that gap because there's really no other warriors who are competent or confident enough to step in who have that world-centric kind of humanities at their heart or in their, you know, in their Kokoro heart, so to speak. So we're really just, we're going through a period of time, and I don't know how long it will last. It might be 20 years. Where the gap is being filled by very bad actors, you know, whether those be state actors or individual actors. I mean, you know, great example of this, my brother-in-law, you know, just basically moved back from Cabo San Lucas. And he went back there. He moved back last year and everything was fine. And he just went back down there to sell his property and whatnot. And he said the entire place has been overrun by the cartels now. And there are literally murders happening every day. And people, you know, the cartels taken over businesses, you know, at gunpoint. I mean, this is Cabo San Lucas, which was a major destination, worldwide destination. And it's gone. That's the age of the warlords at, and how quickly it can happen. So at any rate, you know, I love Gandhi as an example, an early example of this kind of world-centric warrior idea is that he, you know, he said, we've got to be the change you want to see in the world. So you can either have a victim mentality, and the victim mentality is basically saying, we can't do anything about this. These bad people are taking over and, you know, wait around for the government to step in and help us, or you can have a sheepdog mentality, and that's where the individual says, you know what, there's only one person that can really take care of what I need in my life, and that's me. And so, but I need to develop some awareness. I need to develop the self-control to be able to step in to dangerous and crisis situations. I need to, I need some skillful means. And so a lot of the clients who are coming to Unveil Mind and Seal Fit and Arcticore Yoga are looking for skillful means to develop in that in themselves and then in their families and their local tribes, the capacity to step into that sheepdog warrior mentality to be able to step up and take responsibility for, you know, for solving some of these problems. And, you know, it's a critical mass thing. The more people who step up to be warriors and step into their fullness and demand respect and demand that our elected leaders and our, you know, bureaucrats lead by example in the same way, then the more we'll push back against the tide and kind of eventually turn it. So, you know, not unlike what you talk about with your content and the way you dialogue about this, you know, we need to upgrade the human self, the sense of self and consciousness. We can do that through tools like Qualia, and we can do that through training and methodologies that existed for, that have existed for thousands and thousands of years, but have been somewhat dampened down or diluted or didn't even make it over to this culture because we've been so focused on the external and the material. So by embarking on a practice like Arcticore Yoga and engaging in breath awareness and mindfulness and visualization and doing so in a context of developing the self so that you could serve others, then you know, I think that we could really begin to affect culture through, you know, individual action. And it's a different approach than saying like activism, you know, and I think activism is good, but Daniel, to me, you know, there's a lot of people out there involved in activism who don't have their shit together, right? And so the energy comes off as negative or wrong or violent. And so, you know, I think that truly we should be activists from the world-centric level where, you know, there's a win-win solution for everybody regardless of their stage of development and even if they're your enemy.
So trained activism means having enough people who can actually assess the situation, regulate themselves, and have the skillful means to actually improve things rather than get triggered and then cascade the issues.
Exactly.
So talk to us about skillful means development and training. You said something interesting, which was that what you want people doing every day is integrating the various parts mm-hmm. themselves. I think most people have a sense of what physical training means. And mm-hmm. obviously there's a lot of types of physical training for different types of physical capacities, but at least there's some reference. Mental training and emotional training and spiritual training get fuzzier for mm-hmm. large percentage of the population, and how to actually do that, how to know if it's working, what the most effective technologies are. But then what does integration across all of those trainings mean other than just doing all of them?
Well, you have to do all of them in order to integrate them, but in the process of doing all of them, they are integrated, right? So let me see if I can say it this way. So that let's look at what I call the five mountains of a human being. So the five mountains or five domains are the physical. So your physical structure, your physiology. In that category, we can put training of the body, fueling the body through proper nutritious, you know, concepts and practices, hydration, and also physiological control through being able to manage the stress response and bleed off stress. And, you know, so taking care of the body through skillful means is, you know, along those lines. And so Seal Fit really is about that. Like we teach people how to really get into optimal physical, functional physical condition as age appropriate and body type appropriate so that you feel confident and courageous and to fuel properly and to hydrate and sleep and all that kind of stuff. And of course, because we don't operate in a vacuum in the world as a bunch of islands, you know, we need to do this in a team environment. Well, you know, we want the whole team to be strong, right? Because one bad apple spoils the bunch. One weak link will break the chain. And so, you know, we want to train and teach people that training together as a team is really powerful, right? And so right there, now we're already just by addressing the physical training through a daily practice of physical development, you know, that's going to develop you in a way that makes you stronger and more durable and more functionally fit and more confident and able to move your body. We know that's having a very positive neuroplastic effect on the brain now through our research. The training itself requires great focus and concentration. And so we're now getting into the mental mountain where the physical training is starting to develop the mind. Anyone who's been in athletics and endurance training knows that the practice of, you know, I was a competitive swimmer, and no question that being a competitive swimmer developed my mind in a very powerful way. And it had a great effect on my ability to manage stress, because swimming requires breath control and breath awareness. Those are like classic Eastern practices that just happen to kind of be a spillover effect for the swimmer as an endurance athlete. And so through my swimming training, I learned breath control and I learned concentration, right? Those are two core practices of yoga, actually. Anyway, so the physical mountain then prepares the mind through physiological adaptation to stress, as well as development of concentration, for us to then take the mind into deeper territory through awareness, self-awareness, developing some of the meditative practices, you know, that we find in Eastern traditions, but we're completely lost here in the States, in the West, and visualization and whatnot. Now, by training with a team, we're exposed to emotional weaknesses, or what I call blind spots, or BOO, background of obviousness, spots where, you know, you have a, you know, emotional shadow or baggage that is obvious to others because you're dropping little hand grenades around, but you're completely blind to it because it's your pattern that just keeps repeating. So that's one way that we use the body and training of the body to expose emotional patterns and challenges that then become a subject of study through your self-awareness practices, which is part of your mental training. So now you can see how body and mind are bringing us into the emotional mountain to become more aware of the emotional body or aspect of yourself, so that you can then, with skillful means, which is some of the tools that we give you, or with an emotional coach, aka therapist, begin to develop that emotional side of you. Now, as we go through the physical and refine the physical, and then the mind gets more, you have the ability to concentrate and tap into other areas of your mind, that whole mind concept that the Kokoro theme speaks to, and you're emotionally in control and able to assess and not be drawn into the story of your emotions, then you begin to be able to peek even deeper into the human aspect of yourself, which is where the intuitive language, which I believe is like the interpretive language of your soul, is intuition. It's the feeling states of the body, it's imagery, it's insights, it's the ability to intuit and connect energetically with another human being. Those are not it's not coming from your rational mind. It's coming from the non-rational, non-linear heart, mind, belly, mind, nervous system as a mind, consciousness as a mind. And as you start to penetrate those deeper layers, because you're through the physical and the mental and emotional, and they're not blocking you anymore, you're able to be exposed to, you know, that super mind or higher mind or your spiritual self, big S self. And that aspect then is able to shine through a clear lens, and that's why you experience a flowering of your intuitive being, I guess you'd say, your intuitive intelligence. And this is my theory and what I've experienced myself and through our athletes and warriors who we've trained. But you got to go through the physical and the mental and the emotional to be able to get to the intuitive and the spiritual. If you go straight to the spiritual, you kind of block yourself off, and the experience can be limited because your body, mind, emotional system is going to still be kind of coagulated. It's not unlike what I listened when Ken recently said, you know, you wake up to your potential as a human being, and then you begin a process of growing up. We've largely been described the process of growing up, but then you're going to get stuck, or you're going to have that shadow self come back and bite you in the ass. And so you also have to clear up your past, you know, clean up the past. That's the emotional life. And then you can, in my lexicon, open up to your intuitive self so you can show up powerfully in the world.
So you said something very interesting. You said intuitive intelligence was the term you used. So just like someone can actually train their rational ability by studying critical thinking, studying formal logic, studying math, studying science.
Correct.
you're saying that someone can actually train the intuitive intelligence that mm-hmm. is maybe where rational thinking is processing in serial, that the right. intuitive intelligence is kind of processing in parallel, and that that's right. also trainable, and that that's a part of what you're doing. And I would imagine that for world-centric warrior, you're in situations where there's very fast responses that have to happen. Mm-hmm. The serial process isn't necessarily going to give you, but they also have to be very accurate because consequence is high.
That's correct. Yeah. And so I started this training really with special ops candidates back in 2007, 2008. And so, you know, it had to be extremely practical. And the practicality of it was, okay, so we're going to train the body to be durable so you can get through training. And then, but we're going to train them in the mind so you can be focused and focus on the right thing at the right time for the right reasons. But ultimately, our goal is here is, you know, you're going to go out and serve the country. And, you know, in a sense, as an American, as a Navy SEAL, you're serving the world. So I want to make you survivable. I want to essentially resiliency to me was to inoculate you against death, you know, by bullets. And also to inoculate you against the extreme stresses of combat. And so not only do I want to make you physically stronger and mentally more alert and aware, so you're making better linear decisions, like you said, but also so you can be have that, you know, fast twitch spontaneity that you would expect of a world-class elite warrior, right? Both to say, hey, stop, because I detect the presence. I feel the presence of a roadside bomb there, or, you know, my spidey sense is telling me there's someone on the other side of this door. But then the ability to immediately respond, right, with a clear head and a clear heart, so that you can your actions are, you know, what the samurai called shibumi, effortless perfection. That's training. Now, the SEALs train it just through mastery of these basic skills of combat. And what I'm suggesting is that we can also train it through mastering the skills of the inner warrior, breath control, the sacred silence practices of, you know, concentration, visualization, meditation, and, you know, what the yogis called samadhi, which is connecting to source energy, you know, source intelligence.
So let's talk about this. I saw in some research about you that you were called Cyborg during your they gave you during your SEAL training.
Right.
So talk to me about that.
Yeah, that was a nickname given to me by my first platoon at SEAL Team 3. You know, a lot of people think that BUDS stands for Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL Training. That's the preparatory training for the SEAL. It's 6 months long. Now it's considered 9 months long, but we had the extra few months that in our day was done at the team level. Anyway, so 9 months before, 10 months before you're considered a SEAL, and it's arduous, considered the most demanding training in the world. What people don't realize is that once you get into a platoon, the, you know, the cadre of the training environment aren't there to protect you. And the platoon is doing training pretty much, you know, either alone or, you know, with a small cadre from the SEAL team or from the advanced training command that's going to be, you know, directing their efforts. And then when we get out into an operational environment, when you're deployed, you know, you still continue to train, but, you know, now you really have no protective cover except for your, you know, your own wits. And also now we're training, it's the real world, it's the real deal. And so some of the work we do, both training and operationally, is just extraordinarily challenging. Much, much harder than BUDS, right? At any rate, I developed a reputation because I would enter this training and I would prepare myself just like I would prepare myself, you know, for my black belt test or anything. And a lot of that preparation was, you know, was using these skills that, you know, we've been alluding to: breath control, mental management, imagery, visualization, and I learned to use them in kind of a real-time manner. I mean, there's a before prep, and then there's the after, which is kind of like the decompression, the learning, and the you know, the look back. But the during, for me, I learned to use these skills to get into a really deep flow state, to get into a place where the pain really was not any type of, you know, anything that was going to disturb me. Right, it wasn't gonna disrupt my focus or concentration, and so I just showed no pain, no emotion, and was able to just go for hours or days on end at a blistering pace, whether it was a ruck or a swim or, you know, whatever we were doing, you know, and always maintain a positive, friendly attitude and, you know, supportive attitude and keep my eyes on my teammate without any, you know, without breaking down or experiencing or any outward displays of frustration or whatnot. And so my team thought I was a robot. So they started calling me Cyborg.
Okay. This is really important because you're talking about mental and emotional training that you had previously done that right. gave increased capacity to actually do the physical demands that you were obviously training the same as everyone else for the physical demands of the field. Right. And you said some interesting things, not just not showing pain, which is kind of a stoic thing that, I mean, I think we have an image of stoic people that cannot show pain, but not
sure.
and being friendly, right. which is different, right? Because to be friendly means you aren't just completely shut off in robot right. mode. It means that you're right. actually still attuned to other humans. And you right. can show positive affect and emotion.
Absolutely.
Which is a different degree of mastery right. of just shutting down.
I agree 100%. And yeah, there's, like we say this at our 50-hour SEAL Fit training, like we're looking for you not to just go silent and gut through it, because then you're really not very useful to the team. That's not the point. And if we see someone heading down that path, you know, we'll figure out a way to kind of have them either expose failure, you know, that with that technique, or they're and you know, they're essentially going to end up leaving the training, because the effect we're trying to accomplish is that the mental management isn't to just suffer and deal with the suffering, but to thrive in that suffering and to develop a real positive relationship to that. You know, we have this saying that there's integrating pain and disintegrating pain. And so integrating pain is any pain that is making you stronger or that is necessary to get through to a mission accomplishment. As long as you're not, it's not debilitating you, like, you know, you're not literally breaking your leg on a run or, you know, doing something stupid and getting like physically injured. So when you develop a mental relationship with fear and pain, that becomes one of courage and persistence, right? Persistent focus, determination, then you open up a lot of space to be able to bring that same level of discipline and energy to your team, right? Because now you're in control emotionally, physically. You expect it. Like you expect that it's going to suck, but you also know that it could always be worse. And your relationship to that suck is one of humor and kind of a lightness of being, positive dialogue inside. You're seeing the other side clearly. You know what the mission is, and you know that this too will end. And so, in that space, and that you've opened up there, then you know you're desirous of helping your teammates through the same challenge. And then when together everyone starts to resonate at that level, that morphogenic field is created, and all of a sudden, whatever suffering you were going through is irrelevant, right? We're back in mission focused and thriving as a team, right? And so it's a hard thing to really convey in words. It really has to be experienced. People who come to our Kokoro training experience that. Again, it's like it's difficult for me to really convey it in words because it's not really conveyable. Yeah. It's like the unknown and the unknowable. Donald Rumsfeld said, "Prepare for the unknown." The known, the unknown, and the unknowable. This is the unknowable until you experience it. Yeah.
What you're saying that I appreciate so much is it is those attributes that are the foundation of trustworthiness.
Yes.
One of the things that I share with people often is that I modulate my trust with someone based on the worst they ever show up under the most stress.
I like that, yeah.
Because that's, you know, I don't want to expect of them a better behavior than they are going to do sometimes, right? So you mm-hmm. want to see someone under extreme duress and see how they show up. And what you're looking at is how can you actually inoculate people to stress-induced shitty behavior?
Right. That's
so
right.
So that they actually can operate from their values and then actually move their values to higher levels, world-centric values, right. and that they're always available.
That's correct. And, you know, to be fair, we have to expect breakdowns and things not to work because the tools that we've had in the past aren't going to serve us in the future. We can't expect the same strategies to get us to, you know, this, you know, this place that we're talking about. And, you know, I like to say that the world the universe appreciates when you bring yourself to the challenge, because it frees itself up to take care of other people. You know what I mean? So if you take yourself to the challenge, you challenge yourself in sucky ways so that you expose your own weaknesses, identify the gap, and then fill that gap through, you know, through developing the skillful means. And for some people listening, it might be like, oh my gosh, you know, I really need to develop some skills in the art of fighting. Okay, then great. Now you go join a martial art. It's not scary. It's really enjoyable. You know, do some Krav Maga or do some, you know, something that's going to develop some skillful means around awareness and self-defense and taking care of your tribe. That's, everybody should do that. You know, it should not be just for those other people out there, because it's an important skill for our time and age. You know, developing resiliency and mental toughness through like our Unbeatable Mind program, dive into that. It's hard, you know, it takes discipline, but you find very quickly that, you know, discipline is actually, you know, leads you to freedom, right? It's the only way to freedom. So that inoculation can be self-inoculation, but it's a spiraling process, right? It's that transcend and include, right? You, every time you you open a weakness or a gap in your skills, whether they're horizontal or vertical, you endeavor to fill that gap. And that takes great courage and great self-awareness, right?
So I have a question. So you know, my grandfather was Green Beret, Special Forces in World War II in Korea.
And good for him.
He committed suicide later, as so many of the early Green Beret did, because I think the training program for the Special Forces at that time was, the nature of it was such that they did very well in war and they didn't do that well afterwards.
Yeah.
I imagine that's evolved a lot, but we still see a lot of homeless people who are veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of addiction, mental illness, et cetera, from PTSD, from TBI, from whatever, right? Because there's this interesting question about what prepares one for war and the battlefield, and what prepares one for raising children and being in a peaceful situation. There are some crossover strategies, but they're also very contextually different, right? Yes. So I'm curious about training people in a way that they can deal with intense situations when they arise, but they can also be very adaptive to actually be functional and healthy, psychologically healthy and relationally healthy in non-combative environments.
Yeah, that's such a great question. I mean, the way you said your grandfather, right? The way your grandfather trained was not too dissimilar to the way that SEALs are trained to this day. Although I must admit it is changing fairly rapidly. In that it's largely focused on skills, right? Combat skills. And the special operators train, you know, thousands of hours, shooting, jumping, diving, you know, small unit tactics, demolition. And they develop a high degree of competency in it, and they develop a high degree of effectiveness and comfort in operating in, you know, extreme environments and in foreign countries and murky situations in that VUCA world. And those are all powerful skills to have, but they weren't taught the skills of stress management. They weren't taught the skills that we've been talking about of you know, deep reflection and contemplation and meditation and whatnot. Some of the better ones, you know, kind of did it, or if you had kind of Eastern martial training, some of them did it. But that wasn't very common, certainly in your father's day and age, and still not that common today. And so what you end up doing is you get a very effective kind of one-dimensional warrior that can go out and just wreak havoc and survive, but then lacks the means to contextualize that and to reenter and have a normal functional life after that, to bleed off the stress, to find a new purpose, to really reengage with society in a way that's going to be powerful. So a lot of them, you know, kind of drop out or end up committing suicide. And it's a huge problem today in our system. You know, both the military as well as the VA is just, and the medical system is really ill-equipped to deal with them, because they're just throwing, it's like, you know, drugs at them, you know, that are messing them up even further, right? I think that some an insane number of vets is committing suicide every day. It's like 21 or something like that. It's really sad. So my view on this and my experience is that the same tools that I'm using to prepare a warrior to be resilient in combat will, number one, make them more resilient so that some of the effect of combat-related stress bounces off of them, let's say, or they're able to deal with in the moment. But I'm not going to be so bold as to say that they won't accrue a significant amount of stress still. But the same tools then can be used after both after a combat mission or when they're back home to really reorient, to bleed off that stress and to get back into a normal state of being, a balanced state of being. So we really are talking about balance. We're talking about homeostatic balance, mental balance, you know, nervous system balance, and the practices of breath control and concentration and meditation and mindful movement will all have an extraordinary effect on balance. And then the practice self-study, as the way we teach it, self-study in developing and refining one's personal ethos, which includes a strong sense of purpose and why you're on this planet, is the context part, right? And so they go hand in glove, right? So that we prepare our body, mind, and nervous system to be in balance and to be receptive to the vision of the new person that you're creating in your mind and through your discovery process of developing a personal ethos that's going to serve you for the future after the military, let's say. So the skills are used in a little bit different way, but they're the same skills, and it just seems so obvious to me that that's the path to go down. But our world is kind of really weird where, you know, they won't do anything unless there's some sort of study, but it's very, as you know, it's very difficult to study the subjective self with a Western style scientific study, right? It's very difficult. And so I don't have that limitation. I can say, if you trust me, I will tell you that these tools and practices will transform you, whether you're a CEO or an athlete or a warrior, and they'll make you more resilient and more focused and able to handle your job better, and you will also evolve. And then once you trust me enough to say, okay, I'm going to engage with you and begin the training, then the experience takes over. And there's really, I don't have to say anything anymore because they experience the dramatic effect and the transformation that the tools have. And so warriors, you know, especially special operators, tend to be the types of people that don't wait around for authority to tell them do this or do that. But, you know, they're really experimenters. That's why Navy SEALs have been early adopters of, you know, things that you've been working on and a lot of the things that we're kind of collaborating around, as well as these tools. And so I've been teaching Unbeatable Mind and yoga to SEAL trainees since 2007. And I've taken all the foo out of the Kung Fu. I mean, I don't use Sanskrit terms. There's no Hindi. It's basically an American yoga system, Kokoro Yoga. It's an American system. It's broken down into the nuts and bolts with a very clear appreciation for what impact we're looking for from the different skills and tools. And it's been very effective. And the SEAL trainees that I've worked with, the ones who've gone deep with me, 90% of them get through SEAL training, and the 10% who don't, you know, it's usually an injury that was unforeseen, you know, or some dysfunctional movement pattern, or even just an accident. But 90% are getting through SEAL training, and they're off doing incredible work. That's why the SEALs have kind of, structurally, the SEAL proper have taken notice of what we're doing and are finally interested in this type of work. And the Navy at large is studying intuition because of all the feedback they're getting from SEALs and EOD in the field about, you know, precognition and intuition, intuitive experiences and stuff that, you know, all of us as SEALs and special operators have experienced at some level.
Okay. You said 90% success rate. I know that's significantly higher. What is the normal SEAL success rate?
Somewhere between, you know, depending upon where you start counting, but most people will count an average SEAL training class will come in with a couple hundred and graduate somewhere between 20 and 30. So we're talking about a 10 to 15%, sometimes a 20% graduation rate. You know, so that means 85%, you know, fail at some place during the training, most of them in the first you know, first 6 to 8 weeks, you know, which culminates in that Hell Week experience. But the other way to look at it is, you know, there's a couple thousand people, you know, men, and now they allow women to apply, a couple thousand who show up at the recruiter's office who want to be SEALs every year, and they don't even make it to BUDS. And so statistically speaking, it's really more like 1% when you include that whole category.
So I was just with our mutual friend, Jamie Wheel, at
Project. I heard about that. Yeah. I'm sorry. I couldn't make that sound fun.
Yeah, it was. And he was talking about this because he works with new SEALs and training as well. And what the cost is for each actual SEAL that is trained, factoring the total training for them and the attrition of all the people that start the training and don't make it through. He shared an interesting fact, which was of the people that fail basic training, who come back, the ones who come back to try again never make it. And so
that's not exactly true. There are quite a few who have and who do.
Okay. Maybe he was saying the percentage was very small.
Percentage is pretty small, yeah.
So what, I mean, if you say 90% of the people you're working with, either you're working with a very pre-selected audience that's a statistically not relevant data set, or you're doing something radically different. And so let's just look at the radically different part. What are you doing that would increase the chance of success that much? Because obviously it's the guys with the same genetics, right? The same
pretty much
initial motivation capacities.
Yeah, we're working with Martians, so their genetics are slightly different. No, they're I think what you said first is there is an element of these are highly motivated people who are actually willing to spend money and to spend a significant number of years preparing for the SEALs. I mean, I work with one guy who's been literally following my work since he was 12 years old and ended up literally interning with us, you know, for a year. And this guy was honor man of his class. He just destroyed it. And then there's every different type of scenario in between. So what am I doing? It's a lot. It's probably be hard to parse out in just like a few principles, but I would try to do that. One is we're the training that we're giving them is demonstrably different than the training that the Navy says you need to do to prepare. And that is, you know, the Navy says, okay, the minimum standards are body weight standards. And when I mean body weight, I mean pull-ups, push-ups, sit-ups, run, swim. And if you can do a certain number of those exercises in 2 minutes, and you can run in a certain period of time and swim in a certain period of time, then you're considered a qualified candidate. Then you compete based upon your aggregate score to get a slot to go to boot camp or to office candidate school. Well, we have our trainees do that as a bare minimum, right? We want them to obviously dominate that screening test, but that is supplemental training, right? So the core physical training that we give them is twofold. One, and I alluded to some of this before, that it develops like extreme durability. Right? Meaning his SEAL training and any special force training is anywhere from 6 months to, like I said, 9 months long. And it's a freaking grind. You know, you're going for 12, 15 hours a day, sometimes around the clock. And the body just gets worn down to a shred of its former self. And if you don't have the durability in your joints and your spine and in the connective tissue and also in your mind, if you don't have strong, like intense stamina, you ain't going to make it. And so we develop intense stamina, which is beyond endurance. And whereas the military says, go do run, swim, and do these push-ups and sit-ups and pull-ups and make sure you meet the score and you'll be good to go. And that's not accurate. So we develop the physical structure for durability and stamina so that it's got the longevity to make it through that arduous training. The second thing is we place an equal emphasis on training the mind. So we've talked about that. So for us, the mind training, we focus on four key skills for the SEAL candidates. One is controlling the breath, which we will control the physiology so you can always stay in balance. So we teach them the box breathing, which is, you know, we've kind of pioneered box breathing since 2007, and we've taught it to thousands of people, non-warriors and warriors alike. It has a profound effect. If that's the single practice you do, you learn to control the breath and to be able to breathe through your nostrils, and in that pattern, you'll have a profound effect on your health and your mental focusing abilities. So we teach them that, and we have them practice it every day as part of part of their physical training before they train, also in the morning and in the evening. The second is this, I call it positivity. It's the ability to open up some space in your mind to be able to observe the dialogue and the stories and the patterns. So it's not unlike a beginning concentration practice where you begin to separate from the story and run a simultaneous mind, you know. So you have the story mind, and then you have the mind that's watching the stories and then curating those stories. So we call this the witness interdiction process. So we teach this in as a form of developing mental dialogues and mental processing that is very powerful, and it eradicates negativity, eradicates doubt, eradicates any kind of negative mental emotional patterns that will trip you up and cause failure, right? So that in itself is a pretty sweet tool for them. And then the third is how to effectively use imagery, both imagination as well as visualization, and to use that in both a past, present, and a future state, right? So that's a really powerful skill for a warrior and a trainee, right? To be able to see the outcome but let go of it, but to have that outcome still guide them, because they're very clear about what it is that outcome, what that victory looks like. We call that winning in your mind before you step foot in the battlefield. As well as to be able to use the mind imagery in a past state, so you really quickly learn from your mistakes and you can clear up, you know, that past. And then to have a strong image of what your goal is like in the present moment, what victory looks like. So that's the third. And the fourth is task orientation. This is basically the ability to radically focus on the smallest task that's going to lead you to success in this moment and link to the next task, which is going to link to the next task. So this radical focus task orientation allows you to stay very present and micro goal oriented without losing sight of the big picture, because that's part of your imaged self. So I teach these skills to these SEAL candidates, and I have them not just teach it conceptually, I have them practice it and train it and drill it. For, you know, however the duration of time they are with me, whether that's a 3-day or I used to do these 30 days. You alluded to the Bushido samurai tradition. We used to do 30-day live-in immersive trainings that I considered, like I call them warrior monk academies. And we would train, you know, from 6 in the morning till 7 or 8 at night and sometimes around the clock, because I knew that's what they were going to experience in Buzz. But we were training the body-mind to prepare for that. Mm-hmm. So, and then I think the third element is, and I talked about this earlier, is that we train as a team. I teach them that they're not alone. And if they go to SEAL training and think that they're alone and it's about them, that's a big fail. And because the instructors are there looking for their next set of teammates. And so one of the top criteria they're looking for is that ability. Is this person trustworthy? Does he care about his teammates? And so you might have a total stud, MMA fighter, wrestler, high school football jock, quarterback of the football team. And if these people were self-oriented and had not learned to take their eyes off themselves and put them on their team and to really support a teammate or, you know, support a team, they will fail. And oftentimes they're the first to quit, because the instructors are like a bunch of vultures when they see that, because they know that's not what the SEAL teams are all about, right? That's why, you know, I said earlier, that's why this is, you know, the training is so valuable for society today, because, you know, we grew up in this individual Western culture, individualistic. That was the way to go. Everyone wants to, you know, make their mark and do it alone. I don't need anyone else. And that's a recipe for dissatisfaction, unwholesomeness, and ultimately fragmentation and separation. And those are problems, as you know. Those are problems, and it's a lot of what's led us to some of the problems we see in the world, is everyone's acting for their own interests and to the detriment of others or the environment or society or culture at large.
Okay. So you said a lot of very interesting things there. I want to respond to a couple of them. It seems like what you're doing to prepare people is that the current training is almost just selecting for who naturally has some of those things.
Yes. Well said.
Lots of people, but they're not pre-training how to have that for whatever reason. Maybe they didn't figure it out or wasn't cost effective, but you actually figured out how to actually train people who didn't have those qualities physically, spiritually, and mentally, emotionally, and team wise to have those, which is fascinating, because that means it's not just an innate, you have it or not. It is a developable set of capacities.
Right.
And that means not just in warriors, but in everyone, because those right. are very relevant in everyone, that those are developable capacities.
Right. Yeah.
So this is beautiful. So there's a couple of things you said that are very interesting. There's an ethos that I have heard many people speak to since MMA became such a big thing, which is that the traditional martial arts are kind of a joke. A traditional martial artist will get their ass beat in the octagon compared to an MMA fighter. And there was just a lot of like cultural fluff around it. And now we've got this kind of scientific fighting technique. And you're saying something that feels like a very nuanced position, which is there were things that the traditional martial arts had that were not just training physical fighting, but were training mental, emotional capacities that actually matter, that translate to real increased capacity. But then there was also some cultural fluff, or even if it was culturally relevant, it's not relevant to the current cultural context. So you're doing something which is, how do we separate off the ancient limitations of knowledge and the cultural context that isn't relevant, while actually keeping the internal training that is relevant to the external capacity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's... let me talk about a couple things you said. One is... martial arts are, it's tricky because the way it was taught in the East was a lifetime of practice. And the skills were doled out incrementally as the student was ready, right? And you even see this in movies like Karate Kid, where you know you go wax on, wax off on the fence for a year, and then I'll tell you when you're ready. So that was just to get him to kind of settle his mind down, to like stop, you know, let's not be impatient with this. And, you know, the black belt was considered, okay, now you're ready to learn, right? So all the work up into the black belt was just to learn some fundamental skills in punching and kicking. There is no way in God's given earth that anyone up to the, you know, first degree black belt is ever going to win in the ring against a competent MMA fighter. Right, they just haven't even begun to learn how to street fight like them. Now, you train for another 20 years as a martial artist, and you're going to be able to do things that the MMA fighter doesn't even understand, right? And I've seen advanced martial artists, including my own sensei or Kaicho Nakamura, do things that just don't seem humanly possible. Now, his teacher was a guy named Masayama, who cut the horn off of a charging bull with his hand. I witnessed Mr. Nakamura split six blocks of ice. Each block of ice was at least 6 to 8 inches thick, stacked on top of each other, with his head, his forehead. He was using energy that was non-physical, right? It was kinetic. It was chi, force, psychological. It was mastery at that level. I've seen an Aikido master drop someone who just put his hand on his shoulder, and the next moment the guy was on the floor, just through the directing energy into that point of application and some twitch or something that he did. Now that's where the ancient martial arts, you know, and the Chinese and Japanese and even the Korean martial arts, that was meant to be mastered over a long period of time. And through that mastery, you learned how to fight. Now, there are very few martial arts that have the patience for that or the skill to teach that in the West. There are a couple models of a martial, people would call a martial art, which really aren't, that teach extraordinarily effective fighting skills. One of them is the art taught to the SEALs. Now, it wasn't taught as a martial art. It was called self-defense, special combat aggressive reactionary system. That was extraordinarily effective, but it wasn't meant to be used in sport fighting because there was no sport to it, right? If you weren't grievously injuring your opponent, then you shouldn't even be moving your body, right? You should be still in a conversation with the other person trying to talk him out of what's about to happen. So it took, you know, an extraordinarily high level of control to be able to even learn in these arts. And so a lot of, you know, a lot of, they stopped doing it with the SEALs because some of the SEALs didn't even have the control to be able to restrain themselves when they went out in town. You know, someone come up and slap them on the back, and next thing you know, this other person is, you know, on the ground, incapacitated. That art is called the foundation of that art is called Sansu Kung Fu, and Sansu was developed by the Chinese mafia, you know, from an advanced martial artist named Jimmy Chu, I think his name was. And where they, that's where I used to say he stripped the foo out of the Kung Fu and just went straight for the, you know, what's the most effective street fighter. So anyways, you take an advanced Sansu guy and put him in the ring with an MMA guy, and it's game over, in my opinion, because there is no sport there, right? The Sansu guy cannot withhold a punch. If the fight's on, it's like, you know, delivering a nuclear weapon, and bones will be broken and eyeballs removed from socket, that type of thing. That's why it's never displayed in public, right? It's not a sport. So there's a big difference between the sport of fighting, mastering a martial art over 30, 40 years where you can control the energy like I was talking about with Nakamura, or some of these arts where you practice the science of devastation, essentially, the science of injury. So there are three different things, you know, really.
Terrible creatures.
Yeah, there are three different creatures. Now, I'm somewhere between the second and the third, where I believe everyone, you know, should practice these skills over a lifetime. And one of those skills should be the art of self-defense, so that you can take care of yourself and not rely on the 911 call, because that's not going to lead to good results if someone breaks into your home or tries to come steal your purse. And you don't have 30 years to train, you know, to defend yourself in that scenario. So, you know, we have some, you know, collaborators with us who teach that scientific street fighting kind of mode. And we like to make sure that the people who engage in that training have the right mindset for it and the mental and emotional control. So we say, okay, prerequisite to that is the, you know, the other training of SEAL Fit and Unbeatable Mind. And when you combine them, you end up with this really powerful combination of the ability to develop yourself through the ways that we've been talking about, with this kind of kick-ass, very confident attitude that knows that I can handle myself in any situation in my team, so that you don't have to fight, right? Ever since I learned SCARS and the SEALs, I mean, I've never even been close to a fight. It's like it just stays away from me. And I hope by saying those words, someone doesn't like, oh, I'm going to show him, teach him a lesson. It's really an energetic thing. It's almost like the matrix gets changed and you are now, you know, acknowledged as someone who's competent, and the danger of, you know, the dangerous people kind of avoid you because you stepped into the sheepdog. You know, when the wolves are stalking the sheep, they avoid the sheepdog, you know. Make sure he's on the other side of the flock when they go after their prey. The sheepdog will take them down, you know, and that's the attitude that we try to develop in people. And it's completely trainable, like you said. It's not sport though, right? This is life. This is about life. So on the one hand, we want to develop, you know, the peaceful warrior inside of us, but that doesn't mean that you allow yourself to get shit on, right, in life. The warrior is the last one to pick up the lance or to aim the weapon, the last one to cause harm. But when a violent offender or, you know, a terrorist comes along, it's the first one to take action. But he has the ability to discern, you know, appropriately. Now, a great example of the guys on the train in France a couple of years ago who noticed something odd going on, and they're like, this is not going to happen while we're on this train. And so they just got up and stood by the bathroom. Sure enough, the booger eater came out with a weapon and they just took him down. And, you know, we talked about this just recently. Like, imagine if, you know, people are trained when these mass shooting incidences come. And, you know, if you and I and five other guys are sitting around and all of a sudden the shooting has come, if we all, instead of running and hiding the other way, if we all take off toward the attacker, you're going to shock the hell out of them and you're going to take them down. Someone might take a round. Chances are really good that it's not going to be a death shot, because the guy's going to be shocked, and it's very hard to shoot straight when you're shocked or surprised. And you'll end up defusing a situation that could have killed countless, right?
Yeah.
That's what I mean by sheepdog mentality. It takes great emotional control to do that. But when it becomes an imperative, which is part of the warrior ethos, then you know, action is the only way to eliminate doubt in a situation like that.
Now, I want to just kind of clarify, because you're saying something really important that is neither of the common vernaculars on how to deal with this. You've got the people that say, let's just outlaw all the weapons because, you know, we shouldn't have any one of those capacities. But then, of course, that means they just get it on the black market.
Right.
And then we have the Second Amendment people that said everybody should have guns so that we can deal with it. But mostly the Second Amendment people that are saying everyone should have guns are not saying that they should actually train their non-reactivity and their clarity and their skills in the way that you are. So then you just have a lot of poorly trained people with guns.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I'm really glad you said that, because I will say one thing here. I had a recent podcast with a guy named Tim Larkin. He was one of my instructors in SCARS at SEAL Team, at BUDS and SEAL Team 3. He made an attempt at going through SEAL training. He got injured, I think a pulmonary thing, something. So he ended up having to drop out of SEAL training. And then he went to work for Jerry Peterson, who was the founder of SCARS, who was a Sansu master. Anyways, Tim later left to create his own training company called Target Focus Training. It's very effective. It's basically what I'm talking about. It's not a martial art. It's not MMA. It's not a sport. It's teaching you how to deal with life. So I was on a podcast with Tim, and we were talking about guns. And both of us said something to the effect of, it doesn't make any sense that you can buy a gun without some sort of training and, you know, how to use the weapon safely, you know, how to keep it out of the hands of people who could hurt themselves, you know, really basic fundamental stuff. You know, seems to me that it'd be a good idea to require some training. And so, you know, the wrong people don't get injured with a gun. And if you do have to use it, you actually have some skills. And a lot of people naturally understand that and want to get a weapon, immediately go to the range and get, you know, hire a SEAL to teach them how to use it. But you're right. The Second Amendment types are like, that's anathema to them. And I had someone email me and say, well, I was going to come to your SEAL fit training, but now I'm not because of Divine's stance on guns. I'm like, I don't know. I didn't really realize I had a stance on guns, you know, but I have a stance on rationality and sanity, but not necessarily on guns. But one of them is, if you're going to buy a weapon, you should learn how to use it. You don't buy a car and just start driving it. You know, when you get a license, you have to learn how to drive the car. You know, the car's a weapon too. Anyways, I went off on a little tangent there, but.
Well, no, I mean, your point of view is has some nuance in it, which most people are not trained at how to do nuance at all, is that increased capacity to affect things should require increased capacity to make good decisions at how to affect things.
Absolutely.
I would say, you know, from my point of view in our work in existential risk in the world, one of the key issues is that increased technological capacity has meant we have exponentially increasing ability to affect the world without exponentially better decision making.
That's right.
Just towards increased existential and catastrophic risk for everyone.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah.
An AR-15 has a lot more capacity than a handgun, has a lot more capacity than a knife. There should be progressive levels of both training in how to use that and training in how to not use it, right? Which means right decisions and not escalate to violence prematurely.
That's right. Right. And you're right. The most of the training when it comes to, you know, offensive fighting and weaponry is how and when not to use the weapon, right? Again, the warrior, the authentic warrior is the last to pick up the weapon, right? We exhaust all other options. And anyone who's been to war would agree with me. War is anathema. It's painful. It's violent. There's nothing glamorous about it. It is unbelievably atrocious and should be avoided at all cost. The delivery of any weapon, you know, that's going to cause that type of harm should be avoided at all costs. And, you know, we should be having major international conversations, all levels, about eliminating nuclear weapons, not accelerating nuclear weapons. It's just unreal to me that at this stage of development, the human beings, you know, we're still rattling, you know, nuclear war, you know, sabers. It's hard to believe, but I know there's no easy solution through this, right? And even, you know, we could look at it through the integral lens and realize that no matter how evolved you may think you are, there's going to be people at all levels of development and societies at all level of development, and they're going to use whatever tools that technology makes available to them at the time. So like you said, you can have a very low stage development country or culture like North Korea with the highest, you know, power weapons available, you know?
So you said something like as a core of what you're talking about that I don't know if anyone has ever really spoke about clearly, which is what does it mean to be a world-centric warrior? Mm-hmm. Because warriors are, I mean, by definition, they have always been part of who is doing war on one side or the other of a war, which is they are tribal warriors or they are national warriors, right?
Right.
Now, a world-centric warrior that has respect for all sentient life and their goal is the least amount of violence possible. So they will only inflict violence if there is no other nonviolent way of doing it, and doing so prevents otherwise inexorable violence that would have occurred, right?
Right.
But that really means a protector of the whole, a protector of the commons and everything.
Right.
So how do you visualize, like what would you imagine an ideal scenario of what the future of this looks like? Because you're saying war sucks, we don't ever want war, of course.
Right.
And we want warriors. And warriors have traditionally been thought of as the practitioners of war.
Right.
But could also be the protectors against it happening.
Correct. So
vision this.
First of all, I think the world-centric warrior is not just a military practitioner, right? It's not just a job. World-centric warrior would exist as the CEO, right, who has a warrior archetype, and the warrior is someone who's willing to do what's right in spite of the consequences to him or herself, or even his or her company. But since you pose the question in the context of, you know, the military man or woman, because we're on the pointy edge of the spear, we have a great responsibility, right, both to project power and to prevent conflict. And I think the SEALs are a great example of that. Like, we have the ability to just wreak havoc, and we have the ability to, you know, tiptoe around a situation and to deal with it culturally within a sensitive manner and diffuse a potentially violent situation. Now, this is, you know, the SEALs are only 2,000 people. And not all SEALs have this capacity, right? But if you could imagine, and this is where my mind goes, that we begin to implement this type of training in our military and in, you know, even at an earlier stage in different domains, you know, so whether it's business leadership training or even civic affairs, you know, bureaucrats and civic leaders, then you're going to have people from many different walks of life who end up in leadership roles who are thinking in a way that is connective and integrative as opposed to separative and individualistic. And their first response isn't going to be self-preservation and, you know, pulling the weapon out. It's going to be, hey, let's solve this. Let's seek first to understand what's going on here. Let's find a win-win solution. Let's try to understand what's happening in the minds of these other people who are want to do harm. And so, you know, it's kind of like the Buddhist three breath rules. Like, you know, everyone can take a few breaths and just start to, you know, kind of embody the experience and to feel into, hey, what's going on here? Like, how can we dissolve this? How can we move to the other side of conflict in a more graceful way without, you know, a lot of people dying? So that's, you know, creating a world-centric force, you know, of military operatives, of first responders, police, you know, of all sorts of alphabet soup agents, you know, out there. It's unreal how many freaking, you know, deputized people we have in our government in every single agency. We'll start doing the training with them so they can make these good decisions, and then also bring it into the school system. I mean, it's like, it's going to be a multifaceted approach, and there'll be different forms of training. Just mindfulness is one way to do it. You know, I'm not suggesting it needs to be my training, you know. Any type of training that's going to get the Western culture focused on inner development and integrative wholeness, health, heart-mind kind of training is going to do the trick, in my opinion, you know, at least beginning to activate the process at a cultural level. We're starting to see this here. You and I live in Encinitas, California. It's all around us. You know, we have yoga in our school systems here, and, you know, there's a lot of, but at the same time, there's, you know, like equal and opposite force, you know, against that. So it's, you just got to keep pushing against the tide and starting to educate people on the power of this inner warrior development, this inner training. And getting more and more people, I think especially business leaders and entire corporations, to start to adopt these trainings. Because, you know, here's the nice benefit is that every skill that we've talked about that I teach the SEALs is extremely useful for performance and goal achievement, right? It's you know, part and parcel of learning how to think well and tap in more into more of your mental powers. You can use it for self-defense, or you can use it to achieve financial success and well-being, and to achieve any goal in life. So let's use it for both, but ensure that we're doing that in a way that's beneficial for the global commons and not just your individual pocketbook. Right.
And to widen that, right, the step from SEALs to athletes and CEOs is kind of like, there's a clear step in terms of their traditionally male, aggressive, competitive kinds of things. But increased emotional resilience, increased emotional intelligence, increased intuitive capacity, increased mm-hmm. physical resilience, like a mom who wants to not get frustrated with her kids mm-hmm. and actually be able to really sense what's going on with them and know what would be the best strategy for them and navigate all the shit she has to without being overwhelmed and can stay focused on the next task at a time. I mean, it sounds as critically relevant to any goal.
Absolutely. And a lot of that, you know, the relevance is starting to be felt because of the, you know, the world situation that we found ourselves in, right? The acceleration, you know, of technology, artificial intelligence, the merging of all these new technologies to create almost a threatening, you know, another existential crisis, right? With AI, you know, I noted that a few hundred tech leaders, you know, wrote a open letter to the United Nations and the world saying, hey, let's not weaponize AI. That's a really bad idea. I completely concur. You know, so everyone's stepping up and looking at the world saying, holy shit, we need some new tools, right? We need to do things a little bit differently. So I think it's a great opportunity for this conversation to start to be heard a little bit more, you know, I've seen that in over the last few years where things that I've been talking and teaching since the mid 2000s are now, I'm hearing other people say, and it's like, okay, whew, you know, so the message is getting out.
You know, I think the presence of existential threat from North Korea, from climate change, from AI, like everyone feels it, even mm-hmm. if they're not actively following it. And the increasing economic inequality, and like, there's just the chaos of the world creates its own stress on everyone. Right. Mm-hmm. And there's just accumulated trauma that pretty much all parties have. So when you look at the left and you look at, you know, Black Lives Matter movement saying, hey, we never really dealt with the issue that slavery sucked. Right. Like, what does slavery right. really mean? Like generations of torture and servitude, and then got left in no reparations for that. Right. Or the Native Americans like, fuck, that's real. Women saying, hey, we never really dealt with the fact that inequality across gender has been a structural thing. Right. And then on the white nationalist movement being like, well, we're a bunch of white males in the middle of the country that are fucking poor as can be. Right. And that then also feel like we can't get jobs because of affirmative action. There's like authentic trauma everywhere.
For sure.
And then people's trauma bodies respond. Mm-hmm. And so they do dumb strategies, like march on places with torches or shut freeways down that just increase the militarization of the other side. Mm-hmm. And really effective strategies to deal with everyone's trauma, de-escalate and realize we can't kick anybody off the planet effectively is a different thing, right? Like, it used to be that we could just kill other groups and like, we don't want to deal with them. But now all sides have enough military capacity that just that will never work again. Right? Because if we escalate to enough power, they escalate to enough, we destroy the playing field and it's an omni lose-lose game.
Right.
And so we actually have to all figure it out. So I'm extremely enheartened by thinking about the training you're having of if you could work with activists in the Black Lives Matter movement and the People of Color movement and all those, and in the white supremacist and the alt-right movements, and with the police officers, like if you could actually work with them to where they weren't responding from their own trauma, mm-hmm. their own anger, and their own ethnocentric point of view, what could actually be possible and how they would advance that which they have stepped up to protect without being a cause of harm in the process. Mm-hmm. So is this something that you are interested in seeing how to scale for those kinds of purposes?
Yeah, I am. I'm also a little bit uncertain as to how to open up the space for the acceptance of the training. Because, you know, to date, I have trained people who have actively sought out the training, which means they've had the wake up moment. Now they're seeking to grow up and clear up and open up so they can show up more powerfully. And we have a saying with our training that you can't be voluntold to do it. You're just not, it's just not going to land. Right. And so I know there's a way. The tools themselves that I alluded to earlier are, the magic is in the tools. So like we have, I've donated thousands of books of my Unveiled Mind book to the prison population through the Prison Fellowship. We kind of partnered with them to get them in there. And I've had a lot of letters come from prisoners say, man, I read your book. I loved it. And I started box breathing. Wow. You know, I'm all of a sudden way more calm and able to control my emotions and blah, 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 and on and on and on. So I think with these populations, you know, the sensible approach is to be, you know, not go in there with guns blazing that we're going to change their world and make them more world-centric and blah, 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 because they're all going to be defensive and, you know, in their defensive mindset. And what are you doing? And this is just another one of, you know, just another attempt to kind of sway me, control me, right? And so, but if we could get everyone to sit down and do some box breathing together and to do a guided visualization and to start, even just to start a practice of that, then that will crack them wide open and allow for the rest to happen.
And when you're taking people who are scared and pissed off and you're actually training them in increased tools of power, they're already incentivized to that. And if in the process they're learning how to be better stewards of power,
yeah,
that just, so I could see that, I could see that being approachable, effective. Mm-hmm.
For sure. Yeah. And I think it's necessary. You know, I've been looking at this as a long game. You know, if I could influence, you know, 1 million people and train 1 million people, then, you know, they influence 10 people each and, you know, and then pay it forward. Pretty soon we're you know, 20 years, we're at 1 billion people or whatever. But I think a more direct approach might be also necessary, you know, because of the complexity of the problems that we face.
So if anyone that is involved in those movements or who runs the Gates Foundation and wants to actually do meaningful civil work is interested, hoping to scale that kind of training feels like it could be relevant for so many things.
Right. I agree.
Okay. Last two questions. So when we were talking earlier, you know, you said it's really about the tools and you have a number of different trainings for different kinds of tools. You've got your kind of simulation of Hell Week for civilians, for people who want to have that experience. Mm-hmm. And the physical seal fit training, you said what you were actually most excited about, what you would like most people to train in, is the Kokoru yoga.
Right.
Can you speak a little bit about, you know, you're talking about effective tools for inner development.
Mm-hmm.
So what Kokoru yoga is kind of all the most effective tools that you have found.
Right.
Sized into one integrative training.
That's correct. So, you know, Unbeatable Mind grew out of Seal Fit because I had this imperative to learn how to, or to, you know, through my own self-study and working with the SEALs to learn how to train the mind, emotions, minds and emotion mostly. And then because I'm a lifetime martial artist and been a practitioner and teacher of yoga for the last 15 years or so, you know, I've been really kind of digging into that side of the warrior arts. And what I've noticed is that, you know, people have this massive misunderstanding of what yoga is. In its original form, yoga was meant to be a personal practice for self-evolution, for self-development. It's the oldest personal development system on the planet, thousands and thousands of years old. And the term yoga means integration. Look at that. So we're talking about a practice of integration, of evolution, to the highest states of mental development. Patanjali is the guy who codified yoga for us around the turn of the century, or around the turn of, you know, the zero century. So we think, we don't really know how old the sutras are, but he was the first one to kind of write down the philosophy. And, you know, he starts right out in his second sutra that he says, basically yoga is about controlling and training your thoughts, your mind. It's the science of mental development. Whereas in the West, most people have conflated yoga to group exercise, right? There's group movement class. Well, movement was just one aspect. It was the movement of yoga was essentially to prepare the body and the nervous system so that you could sit and go deeper into the inner domain. So you had to go from the outer to the inner. And the yogis understood this, just like we learned that through seal fit. We had to move a body in order to get into the mental, to develop the mind in order to then sit in silence so that we could do our breath training and our mindfulness and our visualization. So I validated kind of these principles, and I was thinking deeply about it. I said, you know what? More people need Kokoro yoga because, or the yoga that I'm teaching these seals, because it's so powerful as a personal practice. So that's the other thing. I said, yoga has been conflated to group exercises, greatly misunderstood, or people think if, you know, you have to like take on a Hindu deity or something like that. Not true, right? Yoga is a gift to humankind. It is world-centric in its approach. It can be stripped of any cultural nuance or context and delivered in a way that is appropriate for anyone of any stage of development in the West, in any country. So I developed this program and wrote a book called Kokoro Yoga. And my stepdaughter, Catherine, who's a longtime yoga instructor, has kind of partnered with me to help teach it. And we just led our second teacher training, which was a 200-hour teacher training. And so some of the uniqueness of Kokoro Yoga is that, like I said, it's a personal practice. So, you know, Daniel, you can do your practice, you know, at home or in the woods or at the gym. You don't need a yoga studio. And what we do is we teach you how to combine some of the tools of movement with breath, with concentration, meditation, visualization in a meaningful way that's going to achieve a specific result that you desire. So, you know, if it's to manage your stress, that's one coupling or grouping or sequencing of the tools. If it's develop power like a warrior, you know, to be able to project power, it's going to be a different sequencing of tools. If it's to prepare for battle or a workout, it's a different sequencing of tools. If it's strictly for spiritual development, it's going to be a different, you know, select tools. It's going to be different if you're 20 years old versus 60 years old. So it really is a meant to be a personally designed, personal practice that's done on your own time. And the practice could be 5 minutes long or it could be an hour and a half, right? And I developed this when I was in combat, actually, and it like had an extraordinary effect on me. And I'm, you know, that's why I wanted to teach it to the SEALs. So that's Kokoro Yoga. Now, the movement practice of Kokoro Yoga includes functional fitness and it includes self-defense, and it includes traditional asana, which is the traditional poses that you think, that people think of yoga. So it's got a very much of a warrior element to it, in that, you know, we're talking about developing the heart and mind of the warrior through this personal practice. The outcomes are a greater courage and confidence and a feeling of being in control, you know, the ability to manage your mind-body system much more effectively, all of the benefits that we talked about earlier without having to get your ass kicked in Navy SEAL-style training or, you know, to be confused about how do I practice it if you're an Unveiled Mind student, because that's mostly philosophy. You know what I mean? It's mostly philosophy and some executive tools. So Kokoro Yoga really is profound, and I think that I think the world's ready for it. That's why I'm excited about it.
So I would love everyone that follows us on NeuroHacker, who's on this podcast, who's interested in kind of neurohacking and personal development optimization and developing themselves for the benefit of the world, to come find out about your stuff, do the training, because it, you know, a tool like the tools that we make at NeuroHacker Qualia, those are really designed to increase capacity, mostly to actually do the practices that can increase deeper capacities. That's not on its own going to replace at all actual authentic training of body mind. So how do people learn more? If someone was like, how do I do Kokoro training or unbeatable mind training?
Sure. I have two business websites. I don't have a personal website because I really want the tools to speak for themselves. So sealfit.com, all one word, SELFIT.com is where you're going to learn about the physical mental training of SEALFIT. And we have our events listed there and our online training. And then unbeatablemind.com, all one word, unbeatablemind.com. Is the second website, which teaches or presents the Unbeatable Mind training for coaching and executives, as well as the Kokoro Yoga online training. And, you know, my books are also a good place to start. So the Unbeatable Mind book is a great, you know, starter kit to kind of go into the whole philosophy. And then I have a book on the yoga training called Kokoro Yoga. And then The Way of the Seal is really about the leadership application of the principles. And those are all available on Amazon and, you know, barnesandnoble.com.
So awesome. These are great resources. And I'll put links in the show notes. You mentioned box breathing a couple times. Mm-hmm. And to leave people with something practical, can you tell people in brief how they can do some kind of box breathing?
Sure thing. So first, it's important, you know, for people to appreciate that this is just breathing, but it's taking deliberate control over our breathings for the purpose of refining our nervous system, our automatic nervous system, so that we can trigger the parasympathetic nervous system and bleed off excess stress and maintain control. Secondarily, it's learning how to, or training the musculature of the breathing mechanism. So your chest muscles, your intercostal, diaphragm in particular, and your belly. So the practice essentially is going to train your musculature and open up your musculature so you can get a full lung of oxygen and really has a great effect on your overall health and your performance if you're an athlete, because you're breathing more fully and completely and exhaling, you know, toxins more completely. And then third, the breath is the bridge between the body and the mind, and the bridge between them, or the link between the mind and the soul. So the, you know, you're taking in life force, right? Pranayama is what the yoga would call box breathing, and it is essentially controlling life force. And so it's a very powerful practice, because beyond all those benefits that I just alluded to, we are literally learning how to bring in more life force, more energy, and that's going to have an extraordinary effect on your peace of mind and your ability to focus, you know, the stimulating your mind for neuroplastic reasons and to prepare it for deeper stages of meditation and for longevity. So it's a powerful practice, and it's super simple. And this one practice is very safe. And if it's the only practice you do in the realm of breath practices, it's, you know, it's money. Okay. So for beginners, I like to say we're gonna focus on a four count. And the breathing pattern will be in the form of a square or a box. That's why I call it box breathing. It's very simple to remember. You're just going to inhale for four count, then you're going to hold your breath for four count, exhale for four count, and then you're going to hold your breath for four count. The inhale fills up the four count, meaning it's not like, and then it's two, three, four. It's slow. You're breathing through your nostrils, which helps valve the air to slow it down. So it's a slow inhale. Full lung capacity. Now, the glottis valve at the back of your larynx is how you close off the air to prevent it from, you know, prevent food from going down into your lungs. So we close that off, but instead of clamping down, creating back pressure like this, we just close it, but create the kind of a lifting sensation as if we are continuing the breath in on the hold, but we're not. So it's inhale four, and then hold for four, and then exhale, release through the nostrils for four counts. And then pressing your belly in, you puff all the air out and hold the breath with that empty lung state for a count of four. And then you release the belly and let that activate the inhale again. So let's do a couple rounds. So start on an exhale. Inhale. Two, three, four, hold the breath, keep that lifting sensation. Two, three, four, exhale. Gently, you feel kind of a sinking and a grounding effect. Hold. Two, three, four, release the belly. Inhale. Two, three, four, hold. Two, three, four, and exhale. Two, three, four, and hold. Two, three, four. Okay, so you can keep doing that, or you know, just release the holds and keep going at that four count. Now, as you get a little bit better, you can increase to a five or a six count, but this is not Navy SEAL breath hold training where you're trying to expand your breath to, you know, hold it for 2 minutes at a time. It's really about the practice. Now, one other tip. So how to stack practices, right? Stacking practices is where you really make some progress and some money. So the first, you experience this physiologically, and then, you know, you're going to experience this notion that, okay, while you're doing that, your mind is still active. So we begin a concentration practice using, let's say, you know, power affirmation or a mantra. And so you could do something like inhale to five count and then hold. And during the hold, you know, you activate your mantra. My mantra when I was in SEAL training, by the way, was feeling good, looking good, ought to be in Hollywood. I said it thousands of times a day. So when you combine a mantra on the holds with the box pattern, it's very, very powerful. Thanks for letting me share that.
Thank you for sharing it. So if people are going to practice this at home, what would you say is minimum effective dose to actually get some meaningful development?
A minimum effective dose would be 5 minutes a day. Best time when you wake up in the morning or, you know, before you head out into the business, because it's very more likely that you'll forget or get distracted. Minimum 5 minutes up to 20 minutes. You don't need to do any more than 20 minutes. Now, it's the key here is daily practice. I'd much rather see you do 5 minutes in the morning every day than to say, okay, I'm just going to get my box breathing in on Saturday and I'm going to do an hour and a half of it. That's not what it's about. It's the daily consistent practice that is rewiring your nervous system, rewiring, you know, how you breathe, you're slowing down. I mean, I do teach like literally 3 or 4 hour long classes on this, but effectively you're slowing your breathing pattern down from an average person breathes like 14 to 16 times a minute. You're slowing it down to between 6 and 8 times a minute, which has an unbelievable effect on just your ability to maintain calm, clear focus. This pattern, there's other patterns of breath that we teach, but this particular pattern of the 1-1-1-1 box, like 4 count or 5 count, is a very balancing kind of neutral pattern. It's not going to stimulate your nervous system too much, and it's not going to calm you down too much and put you to sleep. So it's great to do before. I do this before every speech that I give, anything performance related. I do this as a, you know, as a spot drill. But then there's the morning practice, 20 minutes every morning, and then I'll stack other drills into it, you know, halfway through or toward the end of the box breathing, where then I begin the mantra practice and the visualization and end up in a deep state of meditation.
So if people are going to take on even, say, the 5 minutes a day, do you have a suggestion on open eyes or closed eyes?
Closed eyes is always preferential, right? Because you're going to be less stimulation. Your senses are really what stimulate your mind. And so if you can close your eyes and be in a really quiet space, you know, create what we call a sacred space for your training, not unlike a sit spot for meditation. So you do it there. But, you know, generally speaking, you just don't want any distractions because that's going to, you know, you don't want to be thinking while you're doing this. You want to be really concentrating on the breath and or, you know, this power affirmation. If someone's concerned with eyes closed, then eyes open, soft eyelids, and soft gaze is appropriate, which means that you're using your eyes in a peripheral vision fashion, which is almost akin to like turning them around. So letting energy flow in as opposed to looking out of them and having energy flow out. So soft gaze is appropriate as well.
And if someone's interested in additional elements of mantra and visualization, does the book Kokoro Yoga share more about this?
Yes, we got a ton of practices, breathing and meditation, visualization, all the different, you know, we go through the movements of the basic fundamental martial and functional fitness in asana or, you know, yoga poses, go through the whole philosophy and ethos development. And we also offer some core sequences for different applications like suffering from PTSD, or preparing for a workout, or developing a Zen-like state, or, you know, learning how to fight like a Navy SEAL. So it's all in that book. That's a great book to start with.
Mark, thank you so much for sharing everything that you did today, and for all of this work that you're developing. It feels extremely important and underrepresented anywhere else.
Thank you very much, Daniel. It's been an honor. Hoo-yah.
Thank you. Hoo-yah.
Thank you for listening to Collective Insights. For the full show notes on this episode and for more great interviews, visit us at neurohacker.com/collective-insights. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the podcast and leave us a 5-star review on iTunes.